Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Cover Story, a podcast where we talk with people who write, edit, and publish long-form journalism. My name is Aga Popenda, and today we're talking with Ryan Ruby about his piece titled Child's Play, published this June in The Believer. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Aga. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast.
Thank you. Please tell us a bit about yourself and your various evolving interests, because you do so many things. You do fiction, poetry and prose, nonfiction, literary and cinema criticism and philosophy, translation from French, and at the top of that, you live, work and teach in Berlin, Germany. That's a lot. How all that?
Yeah, only hearing you say it now makes me recognize that is indeed the case. It's hard for me to say which one of these particular genres of writing and modes of writing that I identify with most, but I am the author of a novel, The Zero and the One, which was published in 2017. I've translated two books from the French by Roger Caillois and Grégoire Bouillet for a small, now defunct Berlin publisher called Redux Books. I wrote a book-length poem, which is as yet unpublished, called Context Collapse. And in the meanwhile, I have been making a living, especially in the past year or so, when teaching and editing opportunities have not really been available, as a freelance critic. And as you said, we're here to discuss the piece that I recently put out for The Believer, but other recent work has appeared in Poetry Magazine, the New Left Reviews blog Sidecar, and Book Forum, and there will be forthcoming work in some of those venues as well as The Point.
And when did you acquire French? Because you live in Berlin, I would think that my first impulse would be to think that you translate from German, but no, you translate from French. Is that something that you acquired on the way?
So my French was high school and college French, and I maintained a sort of reading knowledge of French. And when I first arrived in Berlin, I was just looking for work, and I was trying to find... So one of the strange things about my situation is that when I came to Berlin, the condition of the particular visa I'm on is that I had to declare a profession.
Right.
And the profession that I chose to declare was, it's a Freiberufler or a freelance visa. And the profession I chose to declare was writing. And so I'm legally, or was for 5 years, legally obligated only to work in spheres related to writing. And so the irony of my life is that the German state is the guarantor of my continued persistence as a working writer. But to answer your question is I arrived in Berlin and I was just looking for any job that I could get, freelance, teaching, editing. And one of the opportunities that I came across is I met a person called Amanda DeMarco, who herself is a critic, a translator, excellent translator. And she was publishing a small press at the time. And I asked her what I could do, if I could do anything for her. And at the time I had no German, and I had to rely on my French and produce these two small novellas in translation, both of which were a sort of apprenticeship in the learning how to translate, really. And I'm really grateful to Amanda for letting me learn how to do that on the fly, as it were.
Okay, sounds great. Also, are you a magazine long-form journalism reader or solely a producer of such pieces?
I think it's long-form journalism is one of the most sort of exciting sort of everyday forms that is being produced right now. And I would say that, like most people who are working in this sort of industry, at least, there's some great work being put out in this format. So I read it. I read so much of it that I'm hard pressed to think of any one particular example of
to do that.
Like, for example, you interviewed Matthew Karp, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so his recent story in Harper's was fantastic about American history and the 1619 project and the 1776 project and the competing battles over American history in Harper's was fantastic to come up with an example off the top of my head of things that are currently that I've just read and are still in my browser window, the tabs are still open.
And something that just came to my mind, you are a good person to ask. How does the American long-form journalism compare with, let's say, the French scene? Because it seems that you have access to it, and the German scene. How are Americans doing with the long-form journalism?
That might actually be beyond my expertise to say, because I would actually be hard pressed to make comparisons to either of those things, except to say that in both France and Germany, there's a sort of long feuilleton tradition that is culturally codified in a way that does not exist in Anglo-American publications. And so when we talk about long-form journalism, we're also talking about the ways in which prestige publications, but also reader interest is reacting against the sort of total massive generation of very, what shall we call it? Short form journalism, cultural criticism, the sort of quick take. And so the thing about long form journalism in the Anglo-American tradition is that obviously there's a very long tradition of it, but as a sort of special feature, calling it long form at all gives it a sort of like, it's a, almost a privative reaction to the sort of deluge of small 800 word to, let's say, 1,000 word takes that are just produced on a regular basis. And that seems to be a sort of going back to previous traditions of American sort of belletristic writing, which remains continuous in France and Germany, or at least that's how it seems to me in a sort of a from a very sort of superficial standpoint of observation.
All right. Sorry for such an unfair question. So going back to the piece itself, Child's Play, how it exactly came to being and how usually your pieces of that sort come to being. Kind of, do you produce a piece and then you're looking for a publisher? Do you respond to a request? How long does it take you? Where do you take your ideas from? Yeah, however you want to approach it.
Sure. The vast majority of my work as a critic is generated by me going through the sort of pitch routine. So just article idea, pitching it to various editors, and then trying to get buy-in from various editors, various different publications. And so in this respect, Child's Play was unique because the editor in question, James Ye at The Believer, found me to do the article. So James and I know each other from New York, and he had been working on the word book, Wittgenstein's word book, in an editorial capacity. And he was looking for someone to write something about it. And he was in touch with a mutual friend who then told him that I in fact was the right person for the job. And I think actually this is the first time an editor has ever reached out to me to be like, will you write something about this, and to do an actual commission of the piece. So naturally I took it. Of course, I have a long history with Wittgenstein going back to when I was a teenager. So I was sort of delighted to write about this book, which is the Wörterbuch für Volksschulen, or the word book for elementary schools. Mm-hmm. Which is a very, very strange. I never imagined in all of my years of thinking about Wittgenstein that the first piece that I would publish about him was about this very, very strange book that exists in his career.
Okay, so why are you? I have a couple of larger questions about philosophy, but why would Ludwig Wittgenstein? Why were you fascinated by him already as a teenager?
Yeah, so I'll tell the story. I wrote the process, just to go back quickly to another part of your previous question,
yes.
Is the process of writing this article. So James reached out to me in June, and it only appeared about a year later. So this was a sort of interesting project also in this respect that it sort of took about a year to come out. And that had sort of interesting consequences for the actual way it appeared in its final print form. But one of the things that was in an earlier draft was the story of how I came to find out about Wittgenstein. And it's sort of an embarrassing story for me, but I'll tell it anyway here because it's I think it's a very interesting parable of what it's like to be a young person excited about ideas, which was that back in 1999, Time magazine ran a series of special editions about sort of wrap-ups of the 20th century. And at the time, I think my father was a subscriber to Time magazine, and I regarded Time magazine as being a 16-year-old, a sort of, you know, authoritative cultural organ of journalism. And I really sort of look forward to these special editions, which are about literature, music, science, politics, and so on and so forth. And when the special edition came out about sort of thinkers and intellectuals, I went immediately to the philosopher section, and I was expecting to see, you know, like who's the best philosopher of the 20th century. And as a 16-year-old, of course, I knew that the answer to that question was Champollion. And then I turned to the page in which Time magazine had a feature about someone else entirely, this Ludwig Wittgenstein guy, or as I probably would have called him, Wittgenstein at the time. And I looked and I thought to myself, God, I have never heard of this person. He can't be that good. It can't be that good. But of course, this is very classic thing for a 16-year-old to do. But of course, I think I must have clearly had a bad conscience about that, because I have my copy of the Tractatus, and it's dated to April of that year. So I must have immediately gone out and bought a copy of the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus, which is, of course, is Wittgenstein's famous first book. And I distinctly remember opening this book and looking at it and having absolutely no idea what was going on in it. And I was just sort of confronted. I was like, well, you know, I've read Big Nothingness. Everything is easy. And so I looked at this book and I had no idea what was going on in it. And if I have one sole intellectual virtue, it's very small, but it's this, it's that things that I don't understand intrigue me. And at that very moment, I decided that I had to understand what this book was about. Just the sheer impenetrability and of these words on this page, which also involved sort of logic and mathematics, which were way beyond my caliber to an education to understand. And I had to know who this person was, what this meant. At the time, I had already wanted to be a novelist. Actually, that was my career. And the takeaway I immediately had from reading the Tractatus was absolutely devastating, in that the takeaway that I had from the book, from my sort of immature reading, was that language didn't mean anything. This is false, obviously. I remember the first impression, this caused me to be very, very depressed. And so in order, I felt, which is another useful error, to be a novelist, I had to understand how language works. This is false, or not entirely true. But I felt that very strongly that I had to understand how language worked, how meaning worked. And that led me to a degree in philosophy, in which I wrote my bachelor's thesis on Wittgenstein, and a master's degree in philosophy, in which Wittgenstein played a very, very central role in what I wrote about. At which time I had come full circle on Wittgenstein, namely that I had become much more interested in his second book, The Philosophical Investigations. And I had taken, actually, I had come to be convinced that, in fact, Wittgenstein had indeed proved that there were no such thing as philosophical problems, and that philosophy was at an end, and that what I ought to do, in fact, was to go all the way back to my original impulse and to work in fiction instead. And so this is a sort of capsule of my sort of very foolish, very young, very romantic idea about what philosophy was supposed to do, in particular what Wittgenstein was supposed to do. And that was this sort of digression, as it were, into an entirely different mode and realm of thinking that has had sort of interesting consequences for my later career as a writer of criticism, fiction, and poetry. But ultimately, I abandoned by the time my master's degree was finished, I abandoned any interest in the further pursuit of philosophy as a sort of academic discipline or career.
And Child's Play is kind of happening in between those two important Wittgenstein's books, when he kind of abandoning his, let's say, first picture of the language and will be slowly steering towards his other later very different discoveries.
Absolutely. So let me do a quick recap of Wittgenstein's career. It's for your listeners, in case the listeners are sort of not familiar with the overall arc of Wittgenstein's biography. So Wittgenstein is born to an extremely wealthy family. He's one of the richest families in Europe at the time, in Vienna, in the late 19th century. He then goes on to study, and this family is so the haute bourgeoisie of Viennese society. His father was a wealthy industrialist. They had Brahms over to perform. String quartets. One of his sisters was a portrait of her was painted by Klimt. Three of his elder brothers committed suicide, one of whom was a famous piano player, Paul Wittgenstein. Was a famous piano player who had lost an arm, and Ravel composed a piano piece for him. So this is the kind of sort of very high cultural milieu, of course, in Vienna at a very, very interesting time in Vienna's history, at the sort of tail end and decadence and collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He goes to study logic with Bertrand Russell in Cambridge, and he quickly becomes Bertrand Russell's protege, and then his sort of intellectual master. And he's expected he's going to sort of take over for Russell as a logician and mathematician. And the things that they're working on are, issues related to essentially how does language work? How does denotation work? What is mathematics essentially? Is mathematics a set of coherent and meaningful propositions? Can we derive mathematics from logic, and so on and so forth? So they're very sort of heady topics. What happens is World War I breaks out. Wittgenstein goes to serve in the Austrian army. He gets himself requests to be posted to the most sort of dangerous position on the Eastern Front. And as he's fighting, as he's seeing combat on the Eastern Front, he's working on his book, The Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which is in it, his goal is to end the 2,500-year history of philosophy by solving all the philosophical problems. That was his ambition. And he produces, at the end of his time during the war, in fact, in the POW camp, he produces an 80-page, let's call it a proof, which he claims has answered all the questions, or provides the framework for answering all the questions of philosophy. And then he quits because he thinks that he has solved all the problems. There's no more work for him to do. And he decides that he's going to work. He gives away all of his money. He gives away the entirety of his inheritance. So he becomes very poor. But of course, you know, he's a poor aristocrat. And he decides that he's going to go teach children in Austrian village schools. In the trenches, he's been reading Tolstoy. He decides that he's going to embrace a life of poverty and sort of spiritual self-debasement. And he's going to do this by teaching mathematics, but also, you know, language, engineering, in elementary schools in a series of small towns in Lower Austria. And there, the children are, let's say, between ages of sort of, they're sort of preteens, as it were, between 8 and 12. And they're the children of farmers and small shopkeepers in these small villages. And there he writes a book, which is only the second book that he publishes in his lifetime, called the, as I said earlier, the Word Book for Elementary Schools. And it's Wittgenstein's attempt to provide a spelling dictionary to teach these children how to spell. And to make a long story short, at the end of his time as a school teacher, which does not go well, he's a very bad teacher. he's abusive. He's ill-tempered. He's an absolute genius, and he is really impatient and uncaring for the vast majority of his students, most of whom record being absolutely terrified of him. And one can entirely see why that's the case. He is forced to quit. He struck one of his students so hard that they required medical attention. He was forced to quit teaching. And at the time he was in Lower Austria, in Vienna, his book, The Tractatus, has become a huge sensation. And everyone is recognizing, both in Cambridge and in Vienna with a school called the Vienna Circle, a group of people called the Logical Positivists, have hailed this book as now the sort of watershed book of philosophy.
But he's always disillusioned with it, correct?
So exactly. And the irony is he leaves teaching in these villages. He leaves behind this strange word book that he's composed for teaching in rural schools. And he comes back to Vienna and he's being hailed as the sort of the great new philosopher. And he comes back and he basically tells everyone that everything in the book that he had written was wrong, right? That he had not, in fact, solved all of philosophy's problems, because there were no such things as philosophical problems, only philosophical confusions of ordinary language. And he was going to then go back and spend the rest of his career debunking, in other words, the assumptions that went into his first book. And that debunking appears posthumously in a book called The Philosophical Investigations, which is quite amazingly also regarded as one of the most important books of the 20th, philosophy in the 20th century. So here's a person who basically wrote two philosophical masterpieces, the goal of which was to shut down philosophy. And so when people talk about Wittgenstein, they talk about his early period and his late period. And in between those moments, he's working on, there's a series of notebooks that are published, of course, but the one book he publishes is this very small, strange list of words. And the purpose of this list of words is to teach 8 to 12-year-olds how to spell.
Right. But you also claim that, in fact, during his teaching time, he actually learns tons himself and he builds the bridge to, let's say, the second part of his work.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Continue, please.
No. So the strange book is sort of generally regarded as a sort of piece of unimportant ephemera. But actually what's so fascinating about it is in it, if you look at it sort of hard enough, as it were, as an object, you start to see the transition, the sort of ideas that are going to be coming that cause Wittgenstein to reject his earlier work in the Tractatus and to embrace a sort of new philosophy in the Investigations. And in the piece, I sort of discuss what those ideas are, what the early theory of the Tractatus was. Basically, it's a picture theory of language. And the later theory of Wittgenstein is basically, and of course, the philosophers listening, there are nits to pick with this particular characterization, but it's a use theory. And the idea is, when Wittgenstein's in this village, he comes to understand that what language is fundamentally is a series of games. What he calls language, very famously, language games that are informed and connected together by a background of cultural practices. And his involvement with the school children in Austria really alerted him to issues about how language is actually learned, how it's actually used in practical situations, what the influence of a particular, what he calls, form of life, in this case, village life, impacts the way that language is used. All of these cause him to see his early work as overly formalistic, as overly, not as wrong per se, but so narrowly subscribed to be irrelevant to an actual picture of how we use language in the vast majority of circumstances, namely in our everyday life, when it comes with a number of features, not just making true or false statements about the world, but asking for things, expressing desires, commanding people to do things, all of the various sort of features and things we do with language, which is, of course, very influential and is picked up by Oxford Ordinary Language Philosophy and the notion of performativity, which informs so much of our current understanding about how language is used in a sort of anthropological or ethnological sense in ordinary life.
Yeah. And let's add to that that you refer to your own experience as well as a father. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. Like there are two. So in the piece, what was sort of interesting just from a technical point of view is sort of the challenge of this piece is to take this list of words. The list of words, I should say, was published and translated to English by an artist called Paul Chan, who turned it into a sort of artist book. And so there are illustrations in the book. There's a preface by Desiree Rebster. There's a translator's preface. And so the sort of standard way to approach this book is actually as a sort of art book, which is what it was published. That's why it was translated in English and published last year in 2020 by Paul Chan for his own sort of for his own press called Badlands Unlimited. But I wanted to look at it sort of philosophically. What was the importance of this words? And as I was looking through it, when I finally received a copy of this thing, the challenge then presented itself. It's like, well, how do you write something interesting about what is ultimately just a series of words on a piece of paper? And the traditional way to do that is to talk about the art, to do art criticism. But I wanted to talk about philosophy and what can we derive of interest from this series of words. And when I was looking through the book itself, which the words contain everything from discussions about farm implements, discussions about the sort of, it's a very Catholic villages they were living in. So there's discussions from sort of Catholic theology, discussions of various products that would have been available to them, discussions of various like emotions, including alcoholism and anger and so on and so forth. And I'm looking through this series of words to try and figure out how to sort of elicit something from them. And there I noticed that my son's name, my son is called Anton, which is a standard a German name, and would have been a standard Austrian name, apparently. There are many children's names in the book, but I saw it and I thought to myself, well, wouldn't it be funny to try to, and my son, I think, was around the time I received the book, my son was around 18, 19, 20 months old. Wouldn't it be fun to try to teach him to write his name and to perform this experiment of using this book to teach him to actually sort of perform an experiment with the book itself? Like, can it be used in this way? But of course, the book was written for, you know, 8-year-olds. My son was, you know, 20 or so months. And it proved to be an interesting occasion, a sort of interesting reflection about my own relationship to learning, to teaching, to having a child, and all of that sort of is narrated in the piece. And at this point in time, I had already knew that I was going to be writing about this book. But what was so interesting about the piece was because of this sort of year-long time scale in which it was written, I incorporated elements of daily life, including the pandemic, including attempting to teach my son how to write his name, including all the very strange sort of feelings that it brought up in me about my own relationship to education and intelligence, and what I should or should not be passing on to my son. And that all got folded in to the piece as the piece was sort of already under assignment. I should just say, I suppose, for the record, that another thing that was explored much, was occasioned by this and explored much greater length in the earlier drafts was a sort of me working through sort of my ambivalence about being a father in the first place, and what that meant, what that previously existing ambivalence meant, and about the sort of conception of myself as a person that I had when I was much younger. If people ask me, oh, you know, are you going to be a parent someday? And I was like, absolutely not. No way. But what had in fact happened was that life proved to be different. And so it occasioned sort of a series of reflections on the sort of ambivalence I had about wanting to be a father in the first place and what that means for me and for my relationship with my son now that I am one.
Do you think that this experience of being a father will be as important as, you know, being a father for all these school children in Austria to Wittgenstein and, you know, something that put his patience on a test, that this is an important bridge perhaps for you in whatever you will be creating later on? Yeah.
I think so. I think along with this being the first time I've written about Wittgenstein, it's also the first time I've written about being a parent. And as I sort of say in the piece, when I sort of first discovered, you know, that I was going to be a parent, the writers that I was reading, Helen DeWitt, Jenny Ophuls, Sheila Hedy, Maggie Nelson, we're all writing about the sort of way in which the relationship between being a writer and being a parent, in which those two things represent sort of interestingly competing or conflicting responsibilities. And I think that, of course, that there's and each of those different writers talks about that in their fiction in very different ways. But of course, what all those writers have in common, of course, is they're all North American, or at the time, Helen DeWitt was in, I guess, was writing in the UK at the time. So there's a sort of different experience of that in the United States, Canada, and the UK versus in Germany. But of course, the other thing is, of course, that all those writers are women, and the sort of thing that I turned to these writers because they were the only persons that I knew of that we're talking about this. And of course, obviously it goes without saying that having a child as a woman versus having a child as a man is a very, very different experience for all sorts of social, economic, cultural reasons. And it's also very different in each of these various different societies, and it produces different anxieties. But these people were my role model, the people I turned to in order to sort of understand myself as a father, because they were the only people that I found that were actually writing about this sort of ambivalence. And what, in my case, and I say, I should sort of paraphrase this by saying that I think almost the least interesting thing that people when talking about parenting can do is generalize from their particular experience. But in my case, the experience that I had was that what happens is when you become a parent, in my experience, is that the question of whether or not you want to be a parent ceases to become relevant because you simply become a different person, and the questions and the worries and anxieties that at least I had existed, but then they existed sort of intellectually as opposed to existentially. And there's something very Wittgensteinian about this idea, right? Which is that Wittgenstein in the Tractatus very famously talks about how you have to climb, how his book is like a ladder. And then once you climb up it, you have to discard it and throw it away. And then this is the sort of penultimate point he makes. And then he concludes by saying, you know, whereof one cannot speak, one must be silent. And what I find so often is when there's discussions around parenting, we're having discussions between two very different experiences, which are sort of both mutually begging the question against one another. And so what I think is really interesting is that this ambivalence that I certainly experienced, it's not that the ambivalence was solved in one direction or another. What happened was is that the problem ceased to exist, right? The problem had disappeared as a result of moving or changing status or state and becoming a parent, which is a very sort of Wittgensteinian move that I experienced sort of intellectually and experientially through this experience of having a child. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like dying in order to stop being afraid of dying.
That's exactly correct. Like, actually, I distinctly recall, like, the experience that I had was when I found out that I was going to be a parent, I was like, oh, I'm dead. I've just died. And that sounds very strange, right, out of context. But that's a sort of the same ritual or the same experience that you have. You die in the sense that your old self disappears. And for better or for worse, now you're a new self. And this is sort of every important sort of life cycle ritual that we have, whether it's, you know, it's sort of, if you're young and you go through a sort of religious ritual of transition to adulthood, or if you get married, which I'm not, for example, but if you get married, that's a change of state and the old self sort of dies and you're reborn as this new self. And however, you have the memory of what it was like to be your previous self, and you have to rebuild your new self on the basis of the sort of memory of this person you no longer are. And it's that each of these sort of groups of people, the before you and the after you, it's really hard to say which one is better or worse, because you'd simply be begging the question against each other. And in the new state, the question of better and worse no longer arises. And what occurs ultimately in the story, in the piece, is after a long process of attempting to teach Anton to write the first letter of his name, the A, I utterly failed to do it. And I realized that process of that my motivations in trying to teach him this were not good. Were not sort of sound, good parenting motivations. They came from a bad place in me and my old self, and that I should just let it go. And it was an error and a mistake on my part to want to do this in the first place. And then only several months later, did I notice, I walked by him and he was writing on the floor, and he had written the letter A on the floor. And I had realized that it was only after my giving up my desire to do this that I could truly experience this sort of profound joy and pleasure of watching him just do it himself, and to be this autonomous human being who is very pleased to have this new experience. And I really felt like watching him draw that A has given me sort of more profound sense of meaning and satisfaction than in anything that I've ever written, including this piece, in which I recorded a discussion of it. And for me, that was an important moment in thinking about me as a writer, because from youth, from my very early age, and, you know, when I was 16, I'm first encountering Wittgenstein, that's always what I have wanted to be. And I come to realize that this identity that I wanted to have, in some ways I already had it, but in other ways, for me personally, and I'm not speaking about anyone else, but for me personally, it had become, it was no longer a source of the primary mode of meaning in my life. And what was much more important to me was this other mode of meaning.
Yes, because you also, another interesting thing, language aside, in the piece is that you talk about not only being genius, but also about overestimating of being smart, and that, you know, for example, democracy isn't only for smart people, right? And society does not consist, or it shouldn't deliver only to smart people. Can you talk a bit more about that? That was really wonderful.
Yeah, I just speaking personally, the sort of what I say in the piece is that there are many of sort of, again, sort of what we'll call sort of existential aspects of life in which being in the world confronts us with. And one of those things is our relationship to time, our relationship to money, our relationship to our bodies, our relationship to to love and friendship, and each of these things, right, our relationship to religion, each of these things is something that we all confront in our lives in various different ways, coming from the various different positions and backgrounds and experiences that we have. And each of them, you can have a sort of healthy or unhealthy relationship with them. And in the piece, what I say is, for me, what differentiates those two things is you have to have a sort of, this is a very classically sort of philosophical thing, so you have to have a moderate relationship with each of them. And one of the ways you can demonstrate you have a moderate relationship with them is that you become indifferent to them, right? It's a nice thing to have, but it doesn't overwhelm you. You don't fear it too much, but nor are you overinvested in it. And it just becomes a sort of pre-theoretical concern of your life. And in each of those different sort of aspects that I discussed, that requires work. That requires philosophical work.
I would like
yourself.
To ask you. I'm sorry.
Go on.
Yes. Okay. I have you back. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. Can I ask you about what do you read these days? Your favorite writers of fiction and nonfiction, even poetry in general, or recently?
Yes. All of the above. It's been a sort of long degree. It's been a long, the past 2 years I've been reading, because I've been writing so much criticism, I've been reading exclusively for work, which is a very sort of new thing and something I don't entirely like. And I've been trying to read things that are not related to work, but I just don't always have the time for that. I just finished a book by Frederick Jameson's new book on Walter Benjamin. That was just for fun. Right now, I'm reading Rosemary Waldrop for a new piece. I just finished Rivka Galshin's new novel, Everyone Knows Your Mother is a Witch, which I reviewed. And yeah, let's see what's here on the stack. I read a book by William Logan on called Dickinson's Nerves, Frost's Woods, and it's a book of poetry criticism. There's a book by Mark O'Shea about the Metro, which was a lot of fun. He's a sociologist and he's writing about the Paris Metro, which is sort of an interesting little short sociological examination of that space. I love subways and U-Bahns and all forms of public transportation. So that was an enjoyable read. But yeah, like all genres. I think this is my habit as a fiction writer. If you're a writer of fiction, everything goes in, whether it's philosophy, science, literature, history, anything you can get your hands on is useful material to have for your work. And one of the great perks of being a novelist or even writing this kind of long form criticism is that you really get to throw everything in and learn a lot, and experience sort of new and different things that you would not have otherwise experienced, and extend well beyond sort of a narrow sort of specialization. And get as much input from the world, because the world is a sort of wonderful place. And if you're a curious person, then all you want to be is in a position to receive as much of it as possible.
Yeah. We should also probably mention your novel again, 0+1, which I just finished this morning, a gothic twist on the classic tale of innocent abroad. Also something that is, a love letter to philosophy.
More of a cautionary tale, I would describe, of what happens when you take philosophy too seriously, which I love, by the way. I think that everyone should have the experience of taking philosophy too seriously, because it's a nice, the life of the mind is also risky and can be risky and dangerous. And everyone, I think, should have the experience of sort of flirting with the danger of ideas themselves, but only, of course, if you ultimately, again, it's a cautionary tale, so you have to come out on the other side and be able to put these sort of ideas in their appropriate context.
Go ahead, please.
Oh no, just saying that context, both historically. So, for example, like I said earlier, I was an early misreader of Wittgenstein, and it took me approximately 10 years to not be that anymore. And then, of course, there's this existential element of thought where you're experimenting with this in your daily life, and so it's important to be able to place that in the context of yourself as well, to move from mere thought to try to get towards wisdom, which is, of course, the ancient philosophical ideal.
Is Zach and Owen, are they Wittgenstein and Bertrand Russell to some degree, or you don't think that?
Interesting. That's funny. No. Who they are is me. Caught up in the two people. So no one's ever asked me about the novel, so it's amusing to me. But what I did with those two is to cut myself into sort of a duality, and then just really emphasize and push each of the sort of dualities into their sort of extremes. But I think that in both senses, what Zach and Owen would have in common with someone like Russell is a sort of interesting figure. He's a person of insouciance. He's a man of the world. He's the kind of person you would actually want to spend time with. Whereas Wittgenstein is sort of a nightmare, who's so preoccupied and takes everything so seriously. So in this respect, both Zach and Owen are much more in Team Wittgenstein. They take everything at the highest possible pitch of intensity and seriousness. And that's there's a certain romantic sort of likableness to this, even if at the end of the day, that's an ultimately, in my view, an ultimately sort of corrosive way to be.
Yeah. Okay, then maybe let's finish with talking about the new piece that will be published very soon, The Aesthetics of Resistance, Peter Weiss and the Political Novel. Very interesting essay, pretty much, how to say it, some pondering about how we all got obsessed with Trump some years after it happened. So could you tell us a bit what to expect, and which publication will it be published with?
Certainly. So this is a piece about Peter Weiss, and for listeners who don't know Peter Weiss, he's one of the most sort of important German language novelists of the second half of the 20th century. He wrote a 3-volume, 1,000-page long novel called The Aesthetics of Resistance. And this is sort of it's a wonderful book. It's an epic novel set amongst the sort of anti-fascist resistance, first in Berlin, but then the novel expands all throughout Europe during the period between, say, 1938 and 1945-46 for all three novels. And that was the book that I happened to be reading on November 6th, 2016. And what the piece is ultimately a story of reading this book at the beginning and at the what turned out to be the end of the Trump administration, and all the various issues that are occasioned by, the relationship to how we read the world, through what we read the world. It brings up a couple of, by now, rather well-discussed debates about the question of historical analogies to the Nazi period and fascism, the relationship between politics and aesthetics, specifically in the contemporary American novel. So it covers all those particular topics, and it's, you know, it's huge. It's 8,000 words. But what it really is it's a story about confusion, I think, actually. And I remain to this day, here in July 1st, 2021, deeply confused about what happened through the period starting in November 2016 to the present. And what it is trying to make sense of that confusion, trying to work through the sort of strange relationship we currently have to the past, as though it is finished and done with, but strangely not. Vestigially, it sort of lives in our consciousness. It feels as though we haven't swallowed it, or we swallowed it, but we haven't metabolized it quite fully or understood its meaning or implications. And so this is a sort of attempt to provide a sort of first draft of history, as it were, obviously many other people have written about this, and to discuss the role that history plays in understanding our present, and why just exactly it was that it seemed important that we talk about the history of European fascism at this particular moment, whether or not, and of course this is a very strenuous, you know, contentious debate, but whether or not that was true or false, or to what extent it was true or false, seems to me less relevant than that it was the conversation we had. And my interest is what does this conversation and all of our confusions around this particular issue and this particular historical analogy, what does this say about us in this particular case, as Americans in general, and for me in particular, as an American living in Berlin, in the capital of the Third Reich, obviously the former Third Reich, but also reading a novelist by Peter Weiss, who was born here in Berlin, and this book is largely set in Berlin, and what was it like to look at the United States in that period from that set of perspectives?
So what does German people think about this whole attempt of American attempt to, paint Trump and Nazis with the same brushes? What do they think about overusing of this metaphor these days or in recent days?
Well, it's the strange thing is of course, is, and one of the strange, so as you know, the Vergangenheitskultur and memory culture is very important to the German understanding of self. And I recall very definitively that during the 2016 campaign, this was something that was very much on the minds of Germans. The comparisons were fast and furious. People talked about it all the time. And it being in Germany, it was something that occasioned, or at least in a very common sense sort of way, it was that it occasioned no debate, which is to say that the point of memory culture in Germany was to prepare you to precisely, whether or not the analogy is perfect or not, to prepare you to see the kinds of things as similar. And that's true both for what was happening in the United States, but was also happening in France, in Hungary, and also in Germany itself. When it is, I think within the political class itself, there it is less directly spoken of. But when people talk about the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany in a sort of regular way, unless you or yourself are a sympathizer, what they're talking about is either proto or crypto fascists. and it's said in a very unambiguous sort of way. So there's no real question about it. And the similarities between the two parties, between the Alternative for Deutschland and the Trumpist Republican Party, are very quite similar. So throughout the Trump administration, the debate didn't exist to the greatest extent because one of the premises was more largely accepted. And I'm sure if you were to go and look through the entirety of the literature on the matter, you would find obviously German writers saying, well, you know, maybe this isn't as close as, you know, this analogy is sort of infelicitous. I'm sure that happened. But it wasn't consuming to the extent that it was in the United States among people discussing these issues, simply because there was quite literally perceived to be less of a debate. And post 2021, of course, this very strange thing that's happened everywhere is that Germany, and I'd say the most of the European Union is broadly relieved, for better or for worse, to be dealing with what they recognize as quote unquote normal American politicians. And there are some good things about that in the sense that Trump does not dominate, and American politics more generally does not dominate discourse here as it did in that period. And we can actually start talking about German politics. There's an election coming up here in September that's going to be very important. And that's obviously something that needs to be discussed at a German level. But the other thing, of course, is that it seems to me that the Europeans are quite relieved about Biden's election, to the extent that they've, you know, pretending they would like to pretend that Trump was an aberration, that it didn't happen, that it won't happen again, and that they can go back to dealing with this sort of, you know, relationship, whether it's NATO, whether it's trade policy, whether it's any of these things. They're like, yes, well, you know, the old American hegemon is back. We don't have to worry anymore. And in some respects, I think, speaking here personally, that there's a degree of complacency about the relationship between the EU and the United States that has not been sufficiently addressed, as both the United States and the EU have decided to simply move on about the matter, which I think will rear its ugly head again in the future.
Mm-hmm. So that's when can we expect this piece to be published?
So I should say that we have not decided on a final title yet, but I've just sent back the proof changes, and it should be either coming out sometime in the middle or the end of the month in the point.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Ryan.
This is a real pleasure. I really appreciate you being in touch and talking to me about the work.
Thank you so much. You are listening to Cover Story by New Books Network, and we were talking with Ryan Ruby about his piece, Child's Play, published this June in The Believer. Thank you.